The Nature Stories podcast, where people and place intersect.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
As I was growing up, my father was very, very adamant about going out and looking at the weather. And he would say, go out and see what the Sila is doing. What is the Sila like? He always made sure that we were observing what our environment was doing, so that would determine what we would do for that day.
Two generations ago, most Inuit lived as nomads, and Sila, translated as the forces of nature, guided their lives. As Inuit culture changes, so does their relationship to Sila. I'm Samantha Brown. You're listening to the Nature Stories podcast. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection between people and place. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Here now, an excerpt from Inuit, produced by Michelle Ernsting with Radio Netherlands for the series Worlds Apart.
Every night I would bug him to tell me a story, and I would say, "Tata unikartwa laurit," and he would begin the story, "Taitumanigor," a long time ago.
Once upon a time, what seems like a long time ago, Sila was the most powerful force in the lives of the Inuit people of the Canadian Arctic. Two generations ago, most Inuit, or Eskimo as they used to be called, lived a nomadic existence. They hunted caribou, seal, and whale. They depended on good weather to get them safely through another season. In other words, they depended on Sila. An Inuit elder might describe Sila as the natural forces which push and pull a person through life. It takes years of observation and a deep understanding of the Inuit language, Inuktitut, to understand this rich concept. But in two generations, the Inuit language and culture has come under pressure from another overwhelming force, the English language and Southern culture.
When we go outside, we often wanted to determine what it would be like the next day. So late at night, we would get a caribou skin hair, put it up like this to see which direction it would blow, or to see which direction it would move, and that would be an indication of, oh, perhaps it will be kind of cool or windy tomorrow, and from which direction, north, south, east, west, that was sort of an indication. We were also told to practice first thing in the morning to go outside. This was really in preparation to harden us, to prepare us for growing up, so we can be strong.
Naki Echo was born in a hunting camp on the eastern coast of Baffin Island some 90 years ago. What is Sila? It's a strange question for her. Sila simply is. She finds it hard to put the concept into words. But that's exactly what Rachel Kitsualik is trying to do. She's an Inuit writer and translator, and when she was a young girl, her father first helped her to understand the meaning of Sila.
What does my father look like? He looks kind of like Red Butler. Because he's part Scottish. Yeah, so he's got hazel eyes, brown hair, He's got the big, thick eyebrows. But he only speaks Inuktitut, which used to throw everybody off. Yeah. A lot of my memory of camping and traveling came from that time when we were out traveling from part of the North Baffin to the Central Arctic. So we spent a lot of time basically camping outside. Yeah, myself, my father, my mother, a little sister. Yeah. We had a canvas tent, and we had a team of something like 8 to 10 dogs, husky dogs. We had a dog sled. We had all our camping equipment. My father had some traditional hunting gear as well as modern. He had like a couple of rifles. The other thing too was, while we were camping, my father made a point of training us in observation, because that's really critical. Like, you might think that there's nothing there, but a little black dot on the horizon, you know, it could be a seal, could be a polar bear, could be anything. So it was very important to always be aware of, you know, whether there was a food source or if an animal was sneaking upon you, or if something had changed in your environment that meant that the ice was shifting or the land was, you know, blowing snow, that kind of thing. Yeah. As I was growing up, my father was very, very adamant about going out and looking at the weather. And he would say, go out and see what the sila is doing. What is the sila like? So we'd always have this task in the morning to look outside and see what was happening around our environment. Like, he always made sure that we were observing what our environment was doing, so that would determine what we would do for that day.
On this day in Iqaluit, the capital of the Arctic territory of Nunavut, pickup trucks drive up and down the main street and teenagers hang out around the Northern Store, a huge southern-style outlet which sells everything from satellite dishes to fox skins. Some 6,000 people live in this modern city, and out beyond the sprawl of houses, the Arctic barrens stretch as far as the eye can see.
Okay, Adam, he's got to look for it. Kristen, Illy, Jackie, Ami, Deanna, DJ.
This bright, busy building is Jomi Elementary School. Children here can take classes in English, French, and Inuktitut. It's a luxury most of their parents didn't have. They were sent hundreds of miles south to residential schools where speaking Inuktitut was forbidden. Many of those children were unable to cope with the separation from their families and their culture. Some could never reconnect. The teachers at Jomi School hope that by maintaining Inuktitut, these children will be able to bridge northern and southern culture more easily than their parents.
As I spoke to my father, he would talk about that someone who had sila, so-and-so was sila tuyok, the one who had a great sky. I took it for granted that these were the words that meant wisdom, being an elder, having a large sky. Those all just meant that someone was wise. But I think, like, when I think back on it, the idea of sila actually described a lot more than a sky or an environment or the breath or the air. It was more like a concept of a symbol of a beginnings of a religious idea, that there was an entity that was outside of us that determined what we could do. So it was all tied in with life and death. Yeah. I think in the Nutsilingmut, the people of the seal, have an idea, at least in the some of the shamanic belief, that the Sila was more closer to a sky god. Not exactly a god, but more like the beginnings of a sky god, in that the Sila was what determined the forces in our lives. There was Nuna, which is land, and Sila, which was sky. So you were living on the land between the land and Sila. I think when you read your environment, you're able to connect with what is out there. You can predict it to a degree. You can say, well, if the sky is very gray, low on the horizon, and the snow is very white, that means it's going to be bad weather tomorrow. So you're reading your environment, you're more in touch with what it's likely to do, so that you can determine, well, is it going to be a good day to travel tomorrow? How long will it take to get from point A to point B? Because things are not always predictable, so you have to have that edge, as it were, to try to predict from seeing and observing your environment to see what the pattern of it would be.
Louis!
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 This is the Jomi School Land Day. A couple of days each year, the students walk in single file about a kilometer over the hill behind the school to a makeshift camp. A couple of elders volunteer to spend a day at the camp to show the children how they lived as youngsters. The land skills acquired over hundreds of years have all but been lost to these city dwellers. The kids sit about examining each other's lunchbox snacks, everything from Mars bars to raw whale skin. Some help the teachers set up the main tent.
Okay. I'm Luis Joannes. I teach grade 3 in Iqaluit at Jomi School. This is Pauline Iqaluit. She moved from Rankin Inlet to Iqaluit in 1963, so she's been here since.
Our principal had asked her to join us in this land program. We want to focus on our language and just being on the land, exploring, looking for plants, flora, critters, insects, just being on the land, sharing stories and stuff. That's our main goal. She enjoys it.
And when you see the children who are on the land now, do they know what you knew when you were a child?
They don't know as much as they used to know. Right now, these kids, they're more into the white culture, not as much about tradition.
Do you worry that things are going to be lost, that stories are going to be lost?
Yeah, she worries about it. She worries that our culture will be lost.
And what about the language? Do children understand all the Inuktitut words and stories?
Okay. In our language, everything is explainable and direct. There aren't English words for some, like Sila, for example.
And what's the most important thing that you think you can teach the children who come out on these days?
What she thinks is the most important is keeping our culture alive through visual stuff. Learning was vicarious, so what they watched, what they learned. So she was saying that when she used to observe her mom sew and prepare skins, she learned it too from her that way. It was not a matter of this is how you do it, this is the way you do it, sort of, but just learning through observation. So they would walk the whole August nonstop, mainly just hunting caribou. In the fall, that's when they would start going back to the sea, when it started snowing.
So they just watched always the signs around them on the land.
Yeah, they didn't have any calendars. Forecasting would be through stars and the weather.
Does she think children today can forecast? Can they, or do you depend too much on radio and television?
Her grandchildren know more of forecasting from TV since they watch a lot of TV.
It's not going to rain.
It is.
It will.
It might.
A lot of children, I think, now have a very short attention span because of television or different interests that they have. They're not taught to sit and observe things, and I think that's something that we're losing as a part of our skill as Inuit, as an Inuit society. Yeah, I think the idea of where one's place is in a society has really changed from living on the land to now living in a community setting. I think we've lost a lot in a community setting in that we're not doing the same things that we used to on the land. Like, we're not hunting and gathering, we're not observing animals, we're not learning from each other, being a close-knit family or a close-knit group of people. We're not using all of those values to try and survive today. Like, it's not as integral to making a living. I think a lot of it has to do with the loss of meaning, the loss of the structure that was in place while people were living on the land has changed to something that's more wage earning, economy oriented.
The radio is always on in most homes in the town of Pangnirtung, hundreds of kilometers east of Iqaluit. These are the voices of hunters out on the ice. They talk all day long, and those in town tune in to keep up on their news. The community perches at the bottom of a steep fjord. When you land here, you drop alarmingly into a narrow chasm of jagged rock, and then suddenly you're on the tarmac, surrounded by boxy houses. There are only a handful of people on my flight. Two are lawyers, and one is a judge. They come a couple of times a year to hold a mobile court. They have dozens of cases to hear. Most involve charges of assault and battery. Almost all involve alcohol, though it's illegal to bring alcohol into town. I spoke to one teenager as he left the courtroom. He'd been found guilty of assault and battery. He narrowly escaped a prison sentence. He spoke softly and politely and said he was looking for a way to get out of Pangnirtung. He reckoned if he stayed here, he'd end up in jail. He was thinking about going to Iqaluit to get a certificate in welding because he'd heard the money was good. Then he'd be able to come back here often because he couldn't stand the thought of being away. Most of the older residents I spoke to said they would never leave this place and its beautiful, harsh isolation. Simeuni Kinenak is one of them. He's a hunter, and for him, there was never any question of doing anything else.
Yes, I was born to be a hunter, yeah. Yeah, that was the only goal I have when I was a boy, not like boys today. Boys today, they got so many different goals, and a lot of them got lost. We listen to the radio, and we believe the radio. It's happened sometime, what they said. Plus, we still rely on what we know. because it's part of our life too, I guess, to be a hunter. We know in this part of eastern Arctic area, if we get cloud moving or wind blowing from southeast, we know it's going to be bad. If the cloud's moving from northwest, and the color of the clouds, we usually tell, you know, weather going to be bad again in a couple of days. That being carried on from our ancestors, I guess, they learned it and they talked about it and we learned it too. Well, there, I can tell you one story. There was an old guy in town, the really respected hunter. It was in the fall, like November. The ice wasn't even formed yet. And he told his grandson, we're going to have an early breakup, ice breakup. And that's 10 months away. So he asked, how do you know that? And he said, when the ice starts to form down in the flats, down in the ocean, when the tide goes down, and it melts every time the tide goes down. So it shows our seawater is warmer than last year. So these kind of things you could know if you try to know. So all these things are being passed on to us from our grandfathers. They're not just the stories. That's how they know years ago, so we still know them. Our land is it's part of our life. Because for me, that's where I get my food from, out in the land. Not just that, I know my ancestors was there. Like, I go out to the valleys that my grandfather used to hunt, and I see the caribou antlers where my grandfather killed, or great-grandfather killed. And I see the stones that he cast the caribou. And these kind of things are still there. When I see them, it tells me this is my land. My ancestors live here, and I see their graves, and I see caves that they used to live in. We might live in the houses now, but we still very strongly respect our land.
Kids are everywhere in this town. They cycle endlessly on the few kilometers of dirt road. They play in the streams with little homemade styrofoam boats. Though these kids live a more traditional life than most of those in Iqaluit, they can tell you just as much about the internet as about caribou hunting. Inuktitut is their first language, but even the littlest kids shyly speak English when I ask them to explain the meaning of sila.
Outside. Yeah, outside.
Outside?
Yeah.
Is that all it means, outside?
Yeah. Yeah.
So would you say go out, look at the sila?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you have good sila and bad sila?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what would be good sila?
No clear sky. And sunny.
And bad sila?
It's like this and rain and windy, snowy.
So sila, is sila a person? Is sila, no?
No,
outside.
Just outside?
Yeah.
Okay. Everything outside?
Yeah.
Rocks?
Yeah.
Everything?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But rocks are
uya.
Yeah. What are some of the other things we see around us then?
Illu is house. Illu. Grass. Ibishuga.
And boat. Umiak.
Umiak.
Yeah.
And clouds?
Nubuya.
No, Kalli.
Nubuya.
I thought it was. Hila lagi ako. Hila is
heaven.
Hila. Yeah.
Heaven.
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 Can you guys tell what the weather is going to be like? If you look at outside, see the sila. Can you see what's going to come?
Rain.
Yeah, it looks like rain.
Yeah.
See, it looks sunny to me.
It's gonna be sunny, I think.
Sun's gonna go. We won't see
blue skies.
Clouds.
Blue skies are coming.
If I'm translating or if I'm interpreting, I have to think about what is the meaning. I have to think about more about the meaning rather than what is said in terms of word for word. And Inuktitut is so different from English in that a lot of times you don't quite get the point of Inuktitut until you've spoken around it. I think I'm comfortable in either language, but when I speak Inuktitut, I can be a lot more clear about what I'm talking about, and I can, in a sense, be more in myself. I don't have to abstract what I'm talking about. Like, it doesn't strictly come from my head. It can come from the inner part of me. I think it's because I was born with Inuktitut, so it comes out feeling that way. Like, it feels like it's myself speaking. I think there's a very real danger that Inuktitut could be watered down. It already is to a degree in that it's changed to accommodate business done in English. We've already lost a lot of the old meanings of words that we used to use that are no longer in existence. Like, we don't use some really old terms that our forebears used. All of those things haven't been written down. I'm really quite concerned about that, because the more we lose the way we speak about things, the more we lose a perception of our relationship to what we understand reality to be. So I'm very concerned that a lot of our old terms will be lost, a lot of the old meanings will be lost, and I think you lose a kind of a richness of perspective. I think once you lose that, it's like losing an old piece of music or losing, you know, a way of making bread or any kind of an old skill that you have. Once you lose it, it's like losing an extinct species, and once we lose those, they're gone, you know?
Kila tulim.
I suppose one could call that wisdom. All the elements, like stars, sun, sila, is really understanding your one world. There are different types, shapes of stars, which can be as a different indicators to a person. For instance, if you look up in the sky, you will see many shapes of stars. One night you might see stars that is shape of a caribou, for instance, Tutuk-yuak, which is big caribou. It's a sign of, I guess, hope. These things were told to us, so we honored them. We don't analyze them, what they mean. We grew up knowing these things, so whether they're right or wrong, no one tells us that they're wrong. So these are some of the elements that shapes our belief from way back.
To hear more stories like these, go to the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. This podcast is produced with support from the Nature Conservancy, committed to saving the last great places on Earth. Don't miss the next installment of the series Planet Earth, this Sunday, April 15th, on the Discovery Channel. You can learn more about Planet Earth at nature.org/yourplanet. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown. I'll be back next week with a new Nature Stories podcast.